Hey, podcast listeners, Scott Weingart here, and welcome to 2014. This is the first MCRIT episode of the new year. I just finished the MCRIT Mount Sinai Critical Care Conference, and it was pretty amazing. And I had prepared a lecture for that conference about a new paradigm for post-intubation sedation. But unfortunately, it was just too cold for poor little Robbie Orman to fly here and fulfill his conference obligations. And as a result, I wound up giving his lecture on the reversal of anticoagulation instead of this one. So now you get it as a podcast. What we're going to talk about today is post-intubation sedation in the ED in 2014. Now, all the way back in, I don't know, like 3 years ago, I did podcast 21. And podcast 21 was on post-intubation sedation. And I said, you're doing it all wrong. Well, now you're doing even worse if what your standard strategy is in the ED is to give a couple rounds of Ativan and then give them Vecuronium. And back in podcast 21, I lamented people doing that. These patients had no pain control. They were probably under-sedated and they kept on moving around, so people just paralyzed them. If you're still doing that, I don't even know what to tell you, because you're like, now you're like 3 years further out of the loop from what we should be doing. But even if you are fully following the things I recommended in podcast 21, you're probably still not doing it ideally. And this is a paradigm shift for me as well. Now, we've seen rumblings of this change coming for years now, but there's been a culmination of the evidence to the point now I could really do this podcast and make a big recommendation to change the way you handle these patients. But enough foreshadowing, let's get right to it. So here's the deal. Everything you do from the post-intubation sedation perspective should be about keeping your patients oriented, keeping their sleep architecture intact, and preventing delirium. And the first two lead to the third. If your patient is sleeping and their patient's oriented, then they're less likely to get delirium. Now you're like, who cares about delirium? Patient gets a little loopy, no problem. We'll give them more sedation. It's not a problem. It actually is a problem. Delirium essentially equals death in critically ill patients. This is what we're finding more and more. I have a bunch of evidence in the show notes. The show notes, of course, at mcrit.org. Look for podcast 115. And I have a few of just the tons of literature out there. I just put a few select ones there saying that if you wind up delirious in the ICU, you do so much worse than patients that get through their ICU course without delirium. Delirium is bad. Delirium leads to death. That's what you should keep in mind, is do everything possible to prevent delirium. Once an ICU patient is already delirious, things get much tougher, and then we have to try to treat delirium, and we're really not all that good at that. We're much better at just doing good prevention up front. Now, you might say to that, well, okay, I buy it. You know, it'd be good if these patients slept. It would be good if they were kept oriented. It would be good if they never got delirium. But come on, you know, we got bigger things to worry about in the ED, like keeping their blood pressure up and keeping them alive to get to the ICU. And, you know, if we don't do an ideal sedation package, the ICU guys could fix it later. And, you know, in the EDs that the patients were only staying down there a few hours, I was willing to buy that to some extent until a study called SPICE, just like, you know, the Dune books, The Spice Must Flow. The SPICE study, it was an American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care, and they looked at what happens when you had patients who got a good ED, sedation and analgesia package, versus a bad one. And what they were saying was a bad one is patients who were overly sedated, schlogged, knocked out, put down to like the lowest levels of sedation. And they compared those to the ones that weren't. Now, this was not an RCT. So, you know, all the provisos that go along with these observational trials must be observed. But these patients did horribly when they were put down to super deep levels of sedation. And it's probably because that led to delirium. And these patients, you know, just in these first 4 hours did so much better if they had a good sedation package versus a bad one. So let's talk about how to get a good sedation package. Well, in podcast 21, I mentioned this, and I'm going to say it again. We should be doing A1 sedation. Now, that means analgesia first sedation. And we know this is good. In fact, a guy named Strom evaluated analgesia only sedation, which is, you know, you just don't get sedative agents. You just get your pain controlled, and then you just kind of chill out there with your, you know, endotracheal tube in, and you're on the vent, but you're not in any pain, you're not in any discomfort, and you probably get some degree of opioid-induced sedation. So, you know, they're not accounting for that when they say analgesia only, because you look at your heroin addicts and they look pretty sedate when they get to the right level of opioid in their system. But the point is they weren't giving any additional sedatives unless they were forced to. And these patients did better in terms of vent time, in terms of ICU length of stay. Now, I'm not pushing the analgesia only. I'm pushing analgesia first. And that's also been looked at. And it means that trying to cover up a patient who's in pain by giving them more sedatives may lead to them getting oversedated and therefore getting delirious and disoriented and screwing up their sleep. And you don't want to do that. So analgesia first. And how you go about doing that depends on your own hospital, but I think it makes a lot of sense to do one of two things. Either just use fentanyl drips for everyone, that is until the new agents like remifentanil come along, but I don't have it, so I'm just going to talk about fentanyl. So fentanyl drips, which for me is, that's it. You know, that's every patient is getting a fentanyl drip. Or if you just can't handle drips, you're in a tiny community place, you don't want to deal with it, they're only going to be down with you for an hour or two, IV pushes of an opioid. And I think it's probably worth staying synthetic. I think they have less side effects. It just makes more sense. And so probably your drug of choice should be hydromorphone, to my mind. So one of those two seems a great way to go. Now, you're doing the fentanyl drip strategy. It's not enough to just put them on the drip. That's not going to get you where you want. They're going to be markedly under analgesed, and now you're going to be like, this doesn't work. This is stupid. And you're going to go back to just pushing Ativan. What you got to do is you got to put them on a fentanyl drip at some reasonable level, like one microgram per kilogram per hour or 1.5 micrograms per kilogram per hour. And then you got to ask your nurses to just give you a syringe full of the fentanyl. I just draw it up right from the fentanyl drip. That way they don't have to keep going back to the locked narcotic drug cart and getting more and more stuff. They just mix up the fentanyl drip and then you draw from that bag with the nurses knowing what you're doing, or they do it for you and they hand you a syringe of like 100 micrograms of fentanyl. And you like push 50 of it. Come back in 5 minutes. Ask your patient. Actually ask your patient, are you still in pain? Or they might be indicating it by trying to rip their tube out and give them another 50 and then another 50 and then another 50 until you get them to the point where they're just sitting there looking at you like, cool, I feel pretty good. You know, and they won't be able to speak if they have an endotracheal tube in their throat, but they'll be able to indicate and you'll be able to perceive because they're no longer trying to rip out their lines and tubes, that they're doing cool. And now you have an analgesia patient. Now, sometimes this will take like 250, 300 micrograms of fentanyl. And you're doing good by these patients by doing it, because if they need that much, it means that's how much pain they're in. The way I want you to start thinking about this is what is essentially going on with your patients is just take two of your fingers and stick it down your throat and now leave it there for an hour or two. That's what's going on with your patient. It's friggin' miserable. Like, you can't tolerate that for 5 seconds and now you're just asking them to tolerate that for long periods of time. It sucks. And you need to get that control. That's the big source of pain in these patients, is the endotracheal tube in their throat. If you decided to just trach them right now, their pain medication requirements dramatically decrease. That's the key thing to understand. Okay, let's say you've done right by your patient. They're now properly analgesed. They're hanging out there. You know, you say, are you in pain? And they like indicate with their eyes and their head, no, I'm cool. All right, now you probably should sedate them, right? You know, because why should they have to remember all the stuff that's going on, you know, all the cacophony of a busy ED resuscitation area, all that. And I used to say, well, now just let's add in enough sedatives so that they get sleepy and that way they could just chill. Well, now it turns out that's probably not a clever move, because now the patients are disoriented. They're not really perceiving their environment, and that's going to lead to disorientation and delirium. Bad, as I told you. That's what we want to avoid. Now, I used to say, well, won't these patients get, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder from all the misery of being in a critical care unit? Maybe they should just, you know, be made amnestic of all this. And it turns out PTSD is worse if they're disoriented, if they're not perceiving what's going on, and you actually want to keep them aware. The whole point is they should be awake during daylight hours and seeing everything that's going on in their environment, and they should be asleep during nighttime hours, and that's what's going to prevent delirium, or at least that's what we believe is going to prevent delirium. Now, you know, I don't think it's got to be too much fun to just, you know, have the, you know, be locked onto your bed with soft restraints with an endotracheal tube in your throat and have to like perceive your environment. But it turns out that's probably what we should be doing, or bad things ensue. So now that's not a reason to use sedatives. The reason to use sedatives is just to, you know, slightly blunt what's going on, but keep them arousable. And in order to figure this out, you can't just say to your nurses, well, I want them just a little bit sedated, not too much sedated. No, you got to get a scale. And the scale we use is the RASS scale. And I'll put the links to this stuff in the show notes. But what you want is them to be sedated just to the point where if you say, hey, sir, open up your eyes, they immediately open up their eyes. And you don't have to yell at them at, you know, top volume. No, just, hey, how you doing over there? And they open up their eyes and look at you. That is the state of A1 sedation you want them in. So if you got in their pain control, then now if you're going to sedate them, if you're not going to go analgesia only, you sedate them just to the point where their eyes are closed, but you give them any stimulus at all, you know, just, hey, open up your eyes, and now they're opening up their eyes. That's the level you want, and you're really going to need a sedation scale to do that. So RASS of -1, 0, that's where you're keeping most of your patients. If you get a post-arrest hypothermia, if you get a patient with ICP issues, sure, we're going to go deeper, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But for most of your patients, you want them arousable to voice without having to raise your voice. Now, how are you going to get there? Well, in the past, most of these patients, I would have said, use benzodiazepines. Now, we're seeing more and more evidence that benzos are bad for all the things we were talking about that we want. Benzos lead to a disoriented patient. Benzos screw up sleep architecture. Benzos lead to delirium, and therefore benzos are not what we're supposed to be using. Now, the data on this is not definitive, but at this point, I think we've reached that critical mass where most of the smart thinkers in the critical care world are saying avoid benzodiazepines unless you have no other choice. Benzos lead to a longer length of stay, longer vent time, and increased delirium, so we shouldn't be using them if we have other alternatives. And there's a systematic review I put in the show notes that you could take a look at. Now, when I first heard this data, I just said, well, this is probably, you know, the expensive new sedative companies trying to smear benzos. And so I thought that for a few years, and that's why I wouldn't do a podcast like this. I'm starting to see enough where I'm saying, maybe there's something to this. Maybe my recommendations for a midazolam drip are no longer the way to go, and that's why I'm doing this podcast right now. And if you didn't know it already, I'll say it right now. I don't take money from any drug company ever, any manufacturer. So I'm just saying this because I think we're hitting the point where this is probably a good time to make a change. Now, I'll put one more nail in the coffin of things like midazolam drip. You might think, because midazolam is relatively short-acting in procedural sedation, that putting the patient on a midazolam drip is cool because even if it's like not ideal, well, they could just shut it off and put them on something else later on. No, and I want you to understand this. Midazolam drips have been going on for any length of time. They are no longer a short-acting drug. They are a now long-acting drug. Midazolam is only short-acting if you've given it by a bolus and you haven't accumulated the drug with multiple stacking doses. So drips are long-acting. If you just gave them midazolam every hour by push, it would be long-acting, and it's going to take a while to disappear. So you cannot just get away with it for a little while and think they could fix it later on. So really, there's no good reason to stick with benzodiazepines anymore if you have another alternative. So what should you be using? Well, I'm going to give you 3 patient scenarios and make my recommendations for them. Patient scenario 1, you just have your run-of-the-mill, critically ill patient. Maybe they're like a septic guy you're intubating, or what have you. Just normal, run-of-the-mill critical care. They may be somewhat hemodynamically unstable, requiring vasopressors, but with the vasopressors, they're doing okay in terms of hemodynamics. Or they're a little soft, but you haven't even started a drip yet of pressor, and so you have the room to fix them. For those patients, start them up on a fentanyl drip, titrate in the fentanyl to get them analgesed, and then put them on dexmedetomidine. Now, what is dexmedetomidine? You've heard me talk about it a little bit on the podcast during random other issues. Dexmedetomidine is an alpha-2 agonist. It's kind of unique in the world of sedative agents because it gets you a patient who's essentially sleeping, but you give them any stimuli at all, they open up their eyes, and then they go back to sleeping. And it's kind of a unique mechanism. It doesn't disorient them, it just kind of makes them sleep. and it keeps them breathing. It doesn't affect their respiratory drive. It's FDA approved for non-invasive ventilation sedation. And so it's kind of a cool, unique agent. The folks in Europe used to find the same kind of phenomenon when they gave these patients high-dose clonidine, and they would use that as a sedative agent. Dexmedetomidine essentially takes that clonidine and takes out most, not all, most of the blood pressure effects, and therefore you'd use it even in patients whose blood pressure is a little soft. We used to have problems with dexmedetomidine with bradycardia and hypotension. Most of that was because it was being used as a bolus and then a drip, and most ICUs have now just moved to just the drip and not the bolus. There's an FDA locked in, at least in the United States, top dose of 1 microgram per kilogram per hour, which is insufficient in a lot of patients, and most places will go up to like 1.7, 1.8, or 2, and that actually gives you a much greater range to get patients to the sedation scale level you want. You might say, well, I don't have this. Your ICU probably does. They probably kept it away from you because it's expensive. And it's not expensive in like the one-time use thing if you wanted to use it for procedural sedation, and I do that all the time. It would cost you about $60, so it's a drop in the bucket. Problem is, you go through multiple vials of this stuff per day depending on how much the patient weighs, and it is, in many hospitals that have allowed broad-based use, the most expensive agent on their formulary. It's just crazy how many vials you go through and how expensive it could get. It should be going generic in the next few months. The company's going to do everything they can to prevent that from happening. But if it goes through, it's going to be an agent that you will have available. And that's why I'm talking about it right now. Let's say you didn't have dexmedetomidine. Use propofol. Oh, no, you can't use propofol. It's going to make the patient's hemodynamics bad. They're already soft. If you need to, just put them on a vasopressor. Just put them on a vasopressor and use propofol. Propofol is going to be better. It's short acting. It's going to disappear. And since you are, you know, doing the analgesia first strategy, you're not going to have to use high doses of propofol, and you shouldn't have to worry about propofol infusion syndrome. You're going to be using tiny little doses of propofol, just enough to, you know, take the edge off a little bit. So that's your first category. Run-of-the-mill critically ill patient, and fentanyl plus dexmedetomidine or fentanyl plus propofol. And in a lot of patients, you may find you could just go with fentanyl alone. Category two. You got your patient with ICP issues or a patient with delirium tremens. For them, fentanyl, get it on. You might not have much ability to assess their pain level, so just put on a reasonable dose because these patients are obtunded. And then propofol. Propofol is a great agent, decreased cerebral metabolism, have nice effects on ICP. Or if you have your DT patient, it's going to hit the receptors. The GABA receptors through a different mechanism than benzos. It's not going to accumulate, and therefore you could actually turn it off and check a couple of days in if the DTs are resolved. So that's your category two. Category three, the hemodynamically unstable patient who is already on vasopressors and still kind of crappy in terms of their hemodynamics. And, you know, they're on 20 in norepi and you've added in your vaso and they're still a little soft. You can only get them up to a MAP of 50. You don't want to give anything that's going to affect these patients' blood pressure in a worse manner. Fentanyl drip. Fentanyl is a sympatholytic. It's not going to have direct effects on blood pressure. It's going to knock out your patient's own sympathetic tone. Well, that's already, you know, not helping these patients who are at the point they're on multiple pressors and their hemodynamics are still soft. You don't have to worry about that. So put them on a fentanyl drip. And then if you need more pain control or, you know, quote-unquote sedation, it's really dissociation, either give them intermittent boluses of ketamine or put them on a ketamine drip. Now, why am I not recommending ketamine empirically? Well, we have no long-term data on ketamine as a long-term sedation strategy for post-intubation patients. So this is a unique circumstance. Use it. But in the run-of-the-mill patient, I want more data. You know, Strayer, where's the studies? Why don't you do this, dude? But I want more data before I recommend it for run-of-the-mill. But for these patients who are hemodynamically unstable, I think it's a great way to go. All right, let's say you've done everything I'm recommending. What are they going to do in the ICU? Well, in the past in the ICU, we used to think that we had to do these sedation holidays. Well, it turns out you don't. You don't have to do these sedation holidays if you're using the strategy I'm recommending. If you're using analgesia first and you're using sedation only to light level, titrated by scale, turns out there's no benefit from sedation holidays. Sedation holidays is the concept that each day we should just turn off the patient's sedation until the point where they wake up and only then reassess if we can extubate them. And if we can't, then put them back on that deep sedation strategy. Turns out if you do what I'm recommending, you don't even need these sedation oddities. These patients do great if you just keep them light and you don't even have to bother turning it off until you're ready to actually extubate these patients. That was proven in the SLEEP trial, but spelled S-L-E-A-P. And I think it makes a lot of sense. And it's further proof that we're doing the right thing by just leaving these patients at a light level of sedation with analgesia on board. Now, let's say you want to hear more about this. Well, there's the Society of Critical Care Medicine guidelines linked in the show notes. There's a lecture on Maryland CC Project by Dan Herr, who was one of the authors of those SCCM guidelines, and it's a fantastic lecture. Check it out. I put in a whole bunch of review articles in the show notes that I think you should read. One of them, the top 10 myths regarding sedation and delirium, is particularly good. I have a bibliography there with a whole bunch of articles. So let's sum it all up. We can screw these patients up in the first few hours in the ED. We should take an analgesia first route with either a fentanyl drip or a hydromorphone push. We should titrate that until the patient looks like they're out of pain. At that point, if we want to add in some sedatives, we should do it in ways that keep the patient oriented, keep the sleep architecture, and prevent delirium. And that would be either dexmedetomidine, propofol, or in the grossly hemodynamically unstable patient, ketamine, without having very much evidence for that last choice. In the upcoming weeks, you're going to hear all of the lectures from the MCRIT Critical Care Conference. I have a whole bunch of great interviews coming. I have a whole bunch of new show topics on the horizon. I am excited for 2014. Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast saying bye-bye.